topic for this evening is, why is the third world poor? Before I begin, I'd like to make just a few comments to finish some of the things we said last night. And I think that they're relevant to the same issues that we'll be dealing with this evening, so that it won't be too disruptive to what we're going to be doing tonight. I want to just summarize quickly what we said last evening. We were dealing with the call for a new international economic order. My view is that it's not a very radical request on the part of the South. They're saying we would like to play the game that's trading between the countries in the North and the South. They'd like to play that game more fairly. They want to get more power to counter the power that's already in the North. What they really want is an equal economic opportunity, a willingness to use the free trade system. That does not seem very radical to me. That multinational corporations operate with some code of ethics so they don't abuse or misuse their power, that they get some trade unions or cartels to counter the monopoly power in the North, that we cut down on the tariffs, that we put on their finished goods so they can start manufacturing and getting into some of the different stages of production, that they get access to some credit, they have some voting power in the international monetary institutions. All seems very fair. Now, a lot of people, after the last session, were talking about, gee, it sounds kind of fair, and it seems rather reasonable, but do you think it will ever happen? So I want to make just a few comments on that. First of all, I really believe strongly that if it's going to happen, I'd like to see it happen on a voluntary basis. And of course, it isn't until something hits your pocketbook that you become real concerned. But Matthew Fox's book, and I bring it up because it's part of the theme for Holden Village this summer. Matthew Fox's book on compassion says that we desperately need to refine that gift of compassion if we are going to solve these problems. And so I'm very interested in that approach and what Matthew Fox has to say in his book. Many people would accuse me of being a dreamer. Now, it used to bother me at the beginning. You're not realistic. You're a dreamer. Come on. You're going to try and rely on the goodness of people and compassion to solve these problems. Well, I'll admit that my dream may be a big dream, and we need a lot of people to dream that same dream if it's going to work. But the people who think we can continue with the systems we have and the gap growing larger and larger, those who think that is being realistic, or if you move into the nuclear arms race or disrespect for the environment, the people who think that's realistic, I guess I feel that they're really the dreamers. So I hope that we can get more and more dreamers in this area and see if we can bring some changes. A second way that we might get change is it'll be forced on us. And then we brought that up last night. The third world is getting some power. If OPEC's a key to all of this, if OPEC sides with the South, then they do have a lot of power. If OPEC goes its own route and in some ways joins the North, then the South has got some enormous problems. But they may get the bargaining power through military strength, through sheer numbers, through nuclear power. That may be one way in which it will come about. The last option for bringing about a change really is one that stresses mutual interest, mutual benefits on both sides. The Brandt Commission, a lot of the people nowadays who are talking about a new international economic order are stressing the fact that both sides are going to win. And if we don't make some changes, the interruption to free trade and all of that because of our interdependence is going to create enormous problems. And so they're trying to find some way in which everybody's self-interest can be met. And that may be the most realistic way in which a lot of the politicians, et cetera, are going about it. But I'm still going to push Matthew Fox. I can't help it. I think that's where we need to do a lot of work. I want to say one other thing, too, about the North-South debate and the new international economic order. The North is not unified. It is split. The United States probably depends less on trade than any other country. Granted, we really need that oil from the Middle East. Still, we don't rely that much on trade. And for that reason, we've taken the hardest stand. We're the ones that are creating the most problems for continued discussion. If you move to Northern Europe, they rely more on trade, but they've taken probably the next toughest stand. Japan's very dependent on the Third World and seems for its resources and is listening carefully. And then the Scandinavian countries have been very open to what's going on. I might mention, too, that Europe, although the stance has been somewhat tough, also has a lot of old colonies and a lot of people in those countries. And they're doing a much better job of listening to the third world than we are. The South, on the other hand, is not unified either. We've got some countries in Asia, small countries, Taiwan, for example, and in Latin America, some other countries that are developing, that are getting some growth. What kind of development is debatable. But they're not as much hardliners as, say, the poor countries in Africa and Asia. And then there's OPEC. So there are three different groups there. And it is some, they do have some problems trying to present a unified front. What I want to do tonight is move to a little different question. I realize to some extent on international trade, but the question is going to deal with why is the third world poor? And to begin, I think what it would be best to do is just open this up, if we could, to have you suggest some different things. Why do you think the third world countries are so poor? I mentioned their per capita incomes are so low, $200, $500. And our per capita incomes are $8,000, $10,000. What do you think accounts for that? Why is the third world poor? And then I'll try and summarize some of the suggestions that you may throw out. So let's see if we can get a few of these on the board. Anybody want to try?
Colonization, I understand, has, you know, been a dislocation in native industries and native ways of living.
Past colonization.
Like river plantations knocking out the lot of inland.
Okay.
Role of the World Bank.
Role of the World Bank. Are you willing to elaborate on that just a little bit? Okay, if I were to say anything, it may be that in order to develop, you need to save some money, invest in capital, machinery, equipment, and that means you've got to get access to savings. And if you don't have a lot of savings, you can always try and borrow. And the World Bank is the international bank, which does loan money, but there's some very strict conditions under which you can borrow money and get credit. And so it's very difficult to get money for loans, I assume is what you're getting at. Yeah, back up from there.
The role of the United Nations?
Well, I'll ask it again. Are you willing to try to elaborate on that?
No, I was hoping you
would. I'm not really sure what it is you would be getting at here. So if you wanted to pick up on that, fine, I'll come back. Okay, right here.
Maybe there are traditions or a letter.
Okay. Traditional culture.
Infrastructure of the society. Rich heads, in other words. The money that goes out is... The money that is paid for a crop is not necessarily paid to every peasant or every person that produced it, but paid to a certain person who controls the supply, and that money is necessarily then redistributed throughout the society.
Okay, I wouldn't call that infrastructure from where I come from, because when an economist says infrastructure, we're talking about roads, communications, things like that. But you're saying who gets the gains? There are gains, money is received. And how are those gains distributed? Who gets the gains and where do they end up? Yes.
There seems to be an absence of the middle class.
Okay, absence.
Mm-hmm. Going along with that, I don't know if this goes with colonization, but it seems to be a minority that owns the majority of the land. Where you have
okay.
The landless majority.
Distribution of resources, and you were referring to land, is very uneven. In other words,
I'm not sure we can categorize that much differently in our countries. What percentage of the land in this country is held by what percentage of the populace? A very small percentage owns more.
Was that true?
I'm not sure.
When we were in the early stages of development, though, as they were?
No.
I mean, as we've moved more and more towards monopoly capitalism, maybe that explains we're in a later stage, but you're right, that's still a good point. I mean,
what I'm trying to say is that is distinctly different from what we are.
Where we are today, yeah.
Well, the Industrial Revolution took place first in the North, but other things happened before that. I'm not sure how far back you can go. You know, the Roman Empire and the Greeks before that. But real evolution took place in the South first. So, something happened there. I mean, I don't know what in history. If you can elaborate.
Well, I'll put this word down as my interpretation, that the people in the South seem to be latecomers, at least to the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
I'll leave it at that. Yes.
And it's the lack of an industrial base.
Okay. Okay, I saw.
Overpopulation.
Okay, overpopulation.
I'm not really sure how, I think it's really a combination too, but it seems the gains from the industry are not used within the country. They go outside.
Okay. Who gets the gains? Do they, stay in, I'll put the South, in the countries in the South?
I think the roles of the more powerful countries in the world, like the United States and America, act to resist political change in those countries.
Okay. See, that's the North that's going to resist political change in the South.
What's an age differential in the population, too?
Age differential, do you mean by that, that if you look at the distribution of our ages and you break it by five-year periods, we see sort of something that looks like this, and yet when you see their ages, you put the oldest at the top and the youngest?
Older and
okay. Yeah. So what you're getting at is in many countries, if you take the age, say, 16 and under, 40 to 50% of their population is in that age bracket. Okay?
I think one of the main problems is they've been trying to compete from an almost hopeless position. It's like if they build Fords 99% as well as Ford does, they're still not going to sell any Fords.
Okay. I'll come back to this one. Latecomers, meaning that the industrialization has come later to these countries than to the North, and it's difficult to jump in and compete with the North.
Because of climate, I think a subsistence living is easier to achieve in the South. The South is generally tropical. You can grow things without cooperation, whereas in the North, you need to work very hard and cooperate and trade and eke out the existence of cold winters.
Okay. When the fruit grows all year round and you can have cropping all year round and it's fairly easy, you might be content with that as opposed to working so hard to survive during the winter and then you start doing a few more things and, okay, let's see that.
I think also like Western technology, the introduction of that and the lack of education and how to apply it.
Whole question of technology.
Maybe not just not having it, but get taught in the Southwest in our part of the country, what did we do? We invented air conditioning. What did the Latin Americans do? They invented the siesta.
Yeah.
But that, you know,
my view of the siesta is just a little bit different than that. It's that if you have a very poor diet and poor living conditions, and you try and put in a full day's work, you can't do it. And I think that it goes beyond just simply the heat. But
I think it typifies the northern approach to that sort of thing. It's hot and uncomfortable, so let's devise something mechanical.
Okay, let me put a different term in here then. This may be stretching a little, but there's a French term, it's the entrepreneur. Have you ever heard of that term? That the entrepreneur is the person who brings together workers and capital and machinery and everything needed to produce goods. And I think we're talking about an entrepreneurial class that exists down there. And the way they think is there's a problem, we're going to try and solve it. And or has anybody heard of The Need to Achieve by McClellan? We instill in our young the need to achieve. And so if there's a problem, I mean, you do try to overcome it, and you're an achiever, whereas that may not be true in all cultures. Well.
Mark, one up here. I can't see if it's listed or not. I was talking to somebody else. Do you have listed down there the expenditures on defense and military hardware that is made by the third world each year from the quote developed nations, like France, the United States, and what kind of strings are attached to those sales, and how those sales are related to foreign aid, and then also just simply how much of that money, therefore, is funneled out in that manner as opposed to development taking place within that country.
Yeah, I guess.
As I understand it, those numbers are huge and they're growing in leaps and bounds.
You have. You covered several things there, but I might put here, when you do get any gains from trade or growth, do some of those gains go to the military, and that in turn does not end up producing more goods and services? And I know you covered far more than that, but I think I'll leave it there for now. Yes?
One I perceive is a national pride. For instance, you'll take a country that's all sand and oil there, and they have decided that they are going to be self-sufficient in raising their own food, no matter what that costs. Even though they have a climate and so on that is not, you know, like your papayas and last night. They may be in South America, but by God, they're going to grow some lettuce or mixed or they're a Scandinavian country, but man, they're going to somehow figure out how to make some papaya to grow. And so national pride dictates that we're going to spend far more than it would cost us to buy something, just because we want to be self-sufficient.
I'll put that down. I'd be real interested in knowing who is making the decisions and how widespread that is in the country. And in fact, I kind of find it kind of exciting thinking that maybe there is some pride along those lines. But if it's widespread.
I would say that where I've seen it most recently would be in the oil countries.
Yeah. Okay, I think I'll try and put on the board two models and see if I can incorporate some of these ideas in here. And as I do this, I just may leave some out. And I'm afraid that there will be a tendency now for me to start dominating. And so as I do things, interrupt me, challenge me. If I left something out, you know, don't let me get by with talking for too long without letting you get involved. Oh, by the way, you did an excellent job covering a lot of ground there, right? I see that there are two basic views of why the third world is poor. The first view I will call a conventional view. Sometimes it's called the liberal view, but it's the mainstream, conventional view. That term isn't terribly sacred. The description of it will be far more important. And then I'll take a second one, and we'll call it a historical view. I'm going to give you some key terms to summarize or to explain what's happening here. In this model, the problem is the poor are undeveloped. We have the haves in the north, who have quite a bit. We have the have-nots in the south, who don't have much. The problem is the south has been passive. It just hasn't been doing much. I mean, it's just sitting around, not really doing anything to bring about development. What we have here is a dualistic world, two different worlds, one very modern, and one very poor and traditional. But the key is that this area, the South, is undeveloped. And when you take this point of view, you say the problem is the South is lacking some very important things. And you've mentioned some of those. You would say that they are lacking, well, I'll put some on that I heard. They're lacking education. They're lacking technology. They lack capital. And to an economist, capital means machinery and equipment, and as I mentioned last week, if you work with a hoe, you can't produce much. If you work with a garden tractor, you can produce more. That's one person. If you work with a larger tractor, I mean, you need capital equipment. The major problem is, and this is very typical, and it was typical of the United States up until the 1970s, is to look at the South and say, they're poor because they just don't have much. And what do you think would be a solution in this case? What is the responsibility, if there is any, of people in the North to solving this problem?
Well,
Let me give you an example. When, after World War II, Europe was devastated from the bombing, whatever. So we came up with a Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe. And we sent about 3% of our GNP to Europe. We sent money, capital, whatever. And Europe made a rapid recovery. And so in the 50s, we said, now that we helped Europe get back on their feet, let's move to the third world and do the same thing. So what do you do in this solution? What do you send? I just said it. You send technology, you send the experts down, and you send money, all of those things. We did that for about 20 years. That was our major strategy. When I was in school in the late 60s and the very early 70s, I was still studying these models. Here's how the model went. You helped the modern sector. You worked with the people who were already most developed, and you wanted the modern sector to grow. So you put money in there, and they would invest and grow, and as they grew, they would absorb the traditional, the poor sector into it, as there were more jobs. The plan then was, put the emphasis on the rich, the educated, just get more in there, get rapid growth, and it would just spill over to the rest of the people. It was called the Lewis model. Do you know what the results were of that model?
The rich got richer.
Yeah, the rich got quite a bit richer. And the poor did not do very well. I'll just give you a brief synopsis or a summary of what happened. We ended up with mass migrations to the cities, to the modern sector, wherever it was, to get a good paying job. I've been in Lima several times. First time I was in Lima, earlier in the 70s, they were migrating to Lima at the rate of 1,000 people per day. The last time I was there, they were migrating at the rate of 1,500 people per day. That kind of an influx of people is just enormous. Latin America is experiencing this migration in a much higher degree than Africa is. And some places in Asia is quite rapid. That's really an exception. But you get mass migration. What happens when they get in there? And all of this new technology is coming in, pretty sophisticated technology. What's the usually the end result? Mass unemployment. Schumacher says we get a mutual poisoning. You put all your investment, all your attention in the modern sector and hope it absorbs the traditional sector. And what happens? You've ignored the traditional sector. You've ignored the rural areas. And so what do? They take out their revenge on the modern sector. They move in hoping to find a better job. And by the way, most of them in the city feel they're better off. That's the tragic thing. The rural areas have been neglected so much that even though they're in the city without jobs, at least the government will take care of them. They'll keep the food prices down, and they better because there's so many there now. If they don't meet the basic needs, they've got a real potential revolt on their hands. There's mutual poisoning. You ignore the rural sector, they come into the city, and they end up almost like poisoning the city. That has been the end result in too many countries in this model. The problem, why did it work with the Marshall Plan? You know, we put the money and the capital in, but why didn't it work when we did it in the third world? Schumacher, give it a try. I was, and I started answering. Yeah, go ahead, give it a try.
Right, you can say Europe, they already had the technology. It was only that it was destroyed during the war.
Yeah. I would go even a little, it's what you said, I'd elaborate on it. It has to do with a base. The base was there. The education, the understanding, the organization, attitudes, discipline, all of that existed. They were just short, the capital, the money and the technology. We put it in. Schumacher says the problem is when you look at this problem of underdevelopment in these terms, what you're doing is looking at the tip of an iceberg. and the end product is the goods you produce. But underneath this, there's a lot of organization, a lot of education. It's the intangible things you don't see. They have not been developed. So the end product of this model has really been pretty embarrassing for those who have worked with it. I think the model on paper wasn't too terribly bad. It was that it was not implemented very well. And it had a lot of factors that were that it had to overcome that it just didn't handle. I almost hate to say this, but with this high unemployment, we think we have unemployment here, but it is 20-25% in many of these countries, and then most of them have jobs that are considered underemployment. In the barriadas, which are the small villages around Lima, unemployment is as high as 50%. And if you bring in the population issue of, say, 50% of the people being aged, say, 16 and under, you can see what's coming up in the future. There's a real time bomb just sitting there ready to explode. Well, that's one way of looking at it. There's a second way to look at it, and that's to take an historical perspective. If you really want to understand the problems of the third world, it is said that you must understand history and how development took place. So in this situation, understanding history, I guess that's pretty straightforward with a historical point of view, but history is very important here. How did the North develop? And a lot of you have touched on that. And how did the South develop? What's happened? Many would say that this is an active process by which the South is underdeveloped. That may be just a little bit strong, but by underdeveloped it means that they're just not developing very fast. But it's not a passive process. They're not just sitting there not doing anything. They're poor and they're staying poor because of something that's going on. It's an active process that keeps these people poor. I'm going to just read a few things about the history because that came up. What about the history? Is there a middle class? I don't know. I'm not a historian. If anybody wanted to jump in at this at any point and add to this, I'd certainly appreciate that. But in England and France, we had some major revolutions, 1640, 1789, and the French Revolution, in which the middle class replaced the landed gentry. And that really helped capitalism. So in capitalism, in those countries, when they began to develop, there was a very small competitive enterprise, a lot of small businesses. They were all producing goods. And as the capital was produced, what happened was these people were very competitive with each other, and they would reinvest, and you've got entrepreneurs developing, a need for achievement, middle class, and everybody's working hard to improve. However, in the third world, capitalism enters a lot differently than it does or begins in a lot differently than it did in the developed world. Capitalism came through the transfer of fairly advanced monopolistic industry. In other words, the big companies from the north hooked up with those in the south and just simply join forces with the people who are already in control down there. And the people who were in control were a small minority, usually owned a lot of land. Now, the problem in the third world is that vigorous competition for output between small enterprises just didn't exist. And so when they accumulated any kind of a surplus, or they got any extra money, it did not go into the hands of entrepreneurs, a lot of people. It went into the hands of a very small group. This spirit of the middle class was lacking. So there was little reinvestment in capital. What happened when the money went to those who had money, or who were the elite? They usually did one of three things with the surplus. One, what do you think they probably did with those? When they got a surplus, when they received the money, now it's not a middle class, all competing, all trying to grow, all trying to get ahead, entrepreneurial spirit, they just think in those terms, they're landed gentry. They've owned a lot of land most of their life, haven't worked, don't need any more land, but they're getting a surplus from some of the goods that they're selling to or the resources they're giving to some of the north that they've joined forces with. What do you think they did with the surplus when they got it?
Send it outside and come to the north. Much of it went to buy luxury goods from the north because they weren't being produced in the south. Markets too small, technology not advanced enough, so they bought goods from the north. What else might they do?
More land.
Yeah, if you could reinvest in more land. I don't know if it was all owned, who would give up land. But if you have some money, where would you reinvest that money? If you were in the south and you received it, where do you think the best returns are coming? In the north, where the technology is and the advances. And so, I mean, you can't really blame them and say, what are you going to tell them to do? Invest in some high-risk project in their own country, knowing they may lose it all? I mean, they were doing what most people would do. The point is, we don't have any middle class here. Capitalism enters in a very different way. The third thing they did, and it's even more so today, invested a lot of the money in military. And why? To maintain the status quo, to protect what they have. And does that make sense to who am I talking to now? Sure. They want to make sure they maintain what they have, so they find ways to protect themselves. I want to draw now a diagram. It's in a book by Glenn Roberts. Interesting how I spent my 5 years studying in graduate school and reading all the renowned economists. And then this fellow comes along who was a volunteer, a worker in a third world country for some group in England, and writes this little booklet called Questioning Development. And it's just outstanding. It's just loaded with good information. But we didn't get a chance to read it when we were in graduate school. He came up with a nice little diagram. And I'm going to try and show what has become considered the dependency theory. They're underdeveloped. I'm going to look at the dependency theory, which is very related to this whole historical point of view. We'll put a triangle on top. That's going to represent the north. And at the top here, we'll have, I'll call it the elites who live in the north, the stockholders, those who have a lot of wealth. And here we'll put the workers. And then in the south, I'll draw a larger triangle, mainly to represent the fact that the population is much larger down there. And I'll put the elites here, which is a very small group. And here we have the peasants, the farmers, those who work in the mines, and plantations, etc. Now we said there's a very small elite. What happens when the people in the South work, put in a good day's labor, and their population's quite high and keep wages down? Much of what they do passes through the elite, and the resources, remember we said last time they produced mainly raw materials, 80% of raw materials, primary goods, they pass through the elite. They siphon off a certain amount for being part of this process because they probably own the resources in the first place. And then they go up, and our workers in the United States take those goods and process them, add some value to them, and our workers get pretty good wages working with those resources, and then the stockholders and those on top pick up some of the profits. What happens in this situation is that we've got world, it's a world of world situation where we've got monopoly capitalism. Most of the power is up here in the north. That's dollar power. Remember I said per capita income, so much of it, $2.6 trillion is what we earn here in the United States in a year. And then you look at other countries to see what they earn. I mean, their total GNP, what they produce, is just a pittance when you look at our $2.6 trillion. The end product of this, with all this power in the north, is that we have a very lopsided development that takes place in this scheme. I'd like to read several statements about this little diagram. First of all, the structure of underdevelopment, so the structure is a picture there, results from a growth process that is induced from outside. So any growth that takes place in that bottom triangle is induced from outside, basically because that's where the demand is coming from, the income for much of what is being produced. But in the sufficiency economy, it would be a little different. Rather than being generated from within. So they have an external problem, and that's the world economic system. And it's the way it expands, the way the countries in the north expand, the way we expand, dictates a great deal what's going to happen in some of those countries down there. The resources we need. I mean, do we need more oil? Do we need more chromium? Do we need more coffee? Do we need more tomatoes? Depends a lot on our growth and our expansion. Second thing is that the elite in the third world tend to plug into this international economic system. So these people right here, when they do get a good share of the surplus, remember we said the gains are not distributed very fairly, but they do get quite a few of the gains, they have plugged into this system, and so the money often goes into the North, or they buy goods from the North, or they buy military weapons from the North, and so they have a major internal problem. And the internal problem is that their elites are associated with or connected with those who are in the North. Now, I don't know if you can blame them for that. If they were really loyal and had a great deal of, say, national pride, maybe they would turn around and do whatever they could to help the country develop. But when profits dictate what's going on and they want to earn some money, their best returns are in the North. A third point is that the coexistence of the rich and the poor in this existing system, in the coexistence of rich and poor, is really what many consider to be the problem. When the third world integrates itself into a world economy, the result is, I use the word underdevelopment, not that they keep getting poorer and poorer and poorer, but the fact that it's part of an active process. I mean, their position isn't because they're just sitting back and doing nothing. Turns out that they're very dependent on the North. I'll give you a couple ideas or examples of what I mean by dependency. One is an economic dependency, and the demand, much of the demand for what's going on there comes from the North. That may seem crazy, Jeff. Let me give you two examples. If you were living in a poorer country, and you had this nice field next to you, and they were growing tomatoes and good food or whatever, and then you realized that it wasn't owned by the people in your land, and it was being used to feed people in another country, you might say, well, that's okay if we have free trade, and when the people get their income from that, they'll put it back in our country and they'll buy goods from us. But when they see that money going out and a lot of it staying out, or they're not even involved in the process, how do you feel? The best way to turn that around is, I come from Iowa. We're just scared to death because the Germans and the Swiss and the Japanese are buying Iowa farmland. For 2-3 years, we've been trying to pass laws to find out who's buying land. Well, we get real nervous when someone else is buying land. Now, if everybody has some income and some buying power, then we have specialization of free trade. You don't have to worry about it, really. But when you don't even have much income and you see your own land being used and the goods going to another country, it gets to be kind of tough. And then you realize that there's a lot of economic power in the North that's determining how resources right where you are being used. I'm going to give a story just to break this up a little bit. I don't know if I should do this because I'm very reluctant to take on any companies without real good data to support it. But I told a class once during interim that a lot of the big food chains or the restaurants, the fast food restaurants, would buy young cattle and they would send it to some of the islands in the Caribbean to raise the cattle and fatten it. And it's printed in many places, but they don't use names. And then they bring them back in here. And what's happening is when they raise the cattle in some island, they use good land. Why? Because they can afford to buy the land because they have more money. They raise the cattle, send them back, and then we use the hamburgers. After I said that, in January, about February, we came back from the interim, and we were watching television, and my daughter said, or even McDonald's commercial, and she started singing, "Nobody can do it like McDonald's can. Buy cattle from Texas, send it to the islands, send the people to the mountains so they can't eat, and ship it back so we can eat it." And I went, "Gee, girl, that was really kind of clever." She picked up on that. But the point is, those are resources that were being used because we really have a lot of power here. And we can dictate to a great extent what goes on. That's the economic dependency. How we develop affects their country. There's financial dependency. Somebody mentioned about the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. There's cultural dependency. I'm really nervous about cultural dependency. But because we advertise, the companies are in, it turns out that a lot of the goods they buy are the kind of goods that we produce. So you can go to any big country and find the same things you find in the United States. Now, whether that's good or bad, it's easy for us to say, well, that's bad. And I'm not sure how far we can carry it, but there are a lot of people in the South who don't like this cultural domination by the North, the way we have bombarded the media and communication. That's going to be a real big area, the way communications are working in the South. Let me see if I can just summarize this by reading a few points here. Underdevelopment is caused by the present international economic system. That's their point of view. Whether you like that or not, that's what the third world and many of them down there are saying. And I think you need to listen to it. The historical record shows that development of the North is causing underdevelopment in the South and its dependency. Again, they make this statement that underdevelopment in the South is not necessarily any conspiracy on the part of people in the North. It's just the system works that way. You know, how many of you think about where you buy goods and where the resources are coming from and what it might be doing to other people? And I don't think that's the truth at all. Now,
nuclear economics really is to try to put it down, if you want to say that, but to agree with the trend of people or situations where everything. And then as a company grows, if they just reach the South further, we're not going to deal with the South unless we can take advantage of it. That's been history. If it gets to the point where they won't sell their suppliers for what we can produce in the home, you know, minus the transportation costs, we're just not going to deal with it. So they've got to be at a disadvantage, or they're not going to deal with it.
Well,
that's
really
the question. No,
we have to. How do you get, you know, you said the change in demand from the North?
That's a little difficult to answer, if you will, depending on which country. A lot of the internal economies are fairly subsistence, and not a lot of money isn't changing hands. And certainly there is internal demand. And there is some growth going on in those countries. I wouldn't want to deny that at all. There is growth. That's why I say underdevelopment may be a difficult term to work with here. It's more a matter of their development comes very slow. Much of the surplus generated leaves the country. But certainly some are staying there. And there are people who invest locally. But it has been very slow. It has not come very fast. How that comes about is, I suppose, a lot would depend on the country itself. Whatever they do to try and stimulate investment locally, whether it's centrally planned. I don't know if I agree with the statement 100%, because as I mentioned, whenever there's a trade negotiation, there's the opportunity for both sides to benefit. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of what are the sides of the game. And when you're trading with unequal powers, if that happens, when there's just a few buyers and many sellers, so the few buyers have power. Or on the other hand, if there's just a few suppliers, the sellers, but many buyers and the suppliers have the upper hand, then the gains may not be shared very fairly as far as we would feel, at least from a value point.
Well, I guess what I meant also, not necessarily in some of the numbers to the country's demand, but between
oh, but that has been tried quite a bit. They have tried regional development in different areas, and for some reason, it is not working very well. And I can say for some reason, there are a number of good reasons. How do you decide which country gets the industry because they're small countries? There are all kinds of jealousies and little petty issues that they get caught up in. And most of those have not worked, although there's a new interest in trying to initiate those regional types of development with countries. Now, I don't know really where to take it from here.
Wouldn't that be a lot like the small farmer in the United States trying to compete with the corporate farm? I mean, the small farmer is getting eliminated. In the third world, you have a bunch of small farmers competing with the corporate farm of the north, and they're no more successful than a small farmer is in this country.
All right. Now we're moving on to some points that I think I want to make. First of all, I still think that there are some gains to be made, but you've anticipated the next point I was going to read, and that's this. That when you have capitalism and you have large businesses, they will tend, and this is probably one of the more important things I read, they will tend to siphon off the resources from where they are needed most. Somebody mentioned need the other night. Where they're really needed most urgently, basically the poor, whether it's Appalachia or whether it's a poor country in the south, to where they are less necessary. I mean, look, we've got high standards of living. What do we need with the second and third, whatever it is? But somehow it's more profitable, and the resources get siphoned off because of that to the north. There are some multinational corporations in the third world, Brazil, some of the big countries. And there are not all resources go there, but many of them go. And that's one of the real problems with this framework and the historical point of view. Well, the South would maintain that this system that I have on the board, with all of its power, much of its power in the North, maintains and intensifies a system of dependency, misery, and injustice. Notice here we have two systems, North and South. North helps the South. Here it's one system, very closely related. Now, what are the solutions if you believe at all what the South is saying on the right-hand side of this board, the historical point of view? What kind of solutions do you think you need?
Interesting thought. I think something that I heard referred to earlier here is that as in this model here, it's the elite and the north and the south identify with one another, that the farmers in the north, especially I think referring to small farmers, really in a way identify with many of the peasants and the farming people in the rural areas in the south. And that's something that hadn't occurred to me before I was reading Chuck West's book on Christian perspective on agriculture, but I think that's really a challenging thought for...
Yeah, you can always look at examples in the United States. Like, I'll give you another one, along with how the farmers feel. Although I was told last night that it isn't just the small farmers who feel that thing. We talk about monopoly power. And we've been saying, well, that's the market. Berglund has said that several times when they talk about trade. And, well, that's the way the market works. And so if the price of a John Deere tractor is going up, that's the way the market works. But what happened when OPEC raised the prices on it? And they said, that's just the way the monopoly market works. Boy, we sure saw it differently. All of a sudden, it seemed a little unfair. You know, something's wrong. And that's just the market working. And they can push their prices a lot higher and justify it by economic theory. And we've been trying to justify that for years. So yeah, there are many people in the United States who can feel the same things I'm talking about here internationally. Well, what is the solution to this? Yes.
Maybe there has to be a substitute oligarchy in the south. I don't see the same coming from the north.
I think when you get to radical solutions, the two things you see is, one, you want to break the problem in the south. There's that internal problem. The elites control much of what's going on. The second one is this connection between the north and the south. The real radicals say, we don't have much of a chance in this system, and even when we ask for minor changes, which seems pretty fair to us, you don't listen. There are a lot of people who would like to see some radical changes. And so you'll see new development models by countries
for this thing. Maybe we should go to something where we're more self-sufficient. Because when we get tied into this, we get hurt somewhat. So something that didn't come up last night that surprised me slightly, and that was one of the main reasons why the NIEO, the New International Economic Order, is not going very far, is what happens under this system right here if we give in? I don't mean give in is the wrong term, but if we start letting them sell more to us and they get more of the gains and more of the dynamic gains, what happens in that situation? Where are those gains going to go? I mean, most of them. They're going to go right here. And one of the things the North has been saying for a long time is, don't ask us to make changes that make the world economy more fair if you're not willing to do the same thing within your own country. Now, I'm going to carry that one step further. Oh, the United States has said that a lot, and many in the North. And it kind of takes the burden off us. You know, well, I mean, why should we make changes? Then our foreign aid or our trade or whatever is just helping a very small group. Well, I'm going to give you a couple of examples here of how good our rhetoric is. I'm going to list just a few countries who have tried to make that change internally. Chile. You know what happened in Chile? It's so well documented, you can go anywhere and find it. Our CIA, because of the pressure of large businesses, et cetera, which were nationalized, literally brought down that government and put the military back in. I mean, it isn't a secret. It's been in all the papers. It's well publicized. Cuba. What have we done with Cuba? We've had a boycott with Cuba since, I'm not sure when it came in, but not long after Castro was there. Cuba can hardly make it if they can't trade with the United States. They desperately need some trade. We haven't traded with them, so our record doesn't look too good there. Peru, that's sort of controversial. Military government came in there and tried to bring about reform. And the International Monetary Fund put a lot of pressure on Peru, and finally the military government just said, we can't handle it anymore. They had some bad breaks. The anchovies, whatever, dried up, and they thought they had oil in the jungle. They put a lot of money into it, and they didn't get it. So they went into debt. And the IMF, which loaned some of the money, said, we will give you more money if you will do the following things. And almost all the conditions ensured that military government could not stay in. How about Jamaica? Again, Jamaica had some problems. The people who lived in Jamaica at the time and the people in the United States that you talked to say that we almost stopped all tourism to Jamaica when Manley came in and took over the government and tried to bring about changes. And then the IMF promised money, delivered only half. They couldn't make ends meet.
What about the United States?
Okay. And then Tanzania. Tanzania may be one of the few countries left today that's trying to make some changes in this model. They fought a war with Uganda. The United States and Sweden said they would help finance it. When it was over, Sweden said, we can't finance it. We're neutral. What will our people think? And the United States did not come through with the money, at least what I've been told by people from Tanzania, that they said they would do. So, we say we want changes, but we haven't been very supportive of those changes when they've come. Now, I can't go over too late tonight. I've got a few minutes left. I want to bring up another topic, and that is, if dependency is a problem here, there's a theme coming out of Latin America, basically. It's a liberation theme. And I want to just read a couple things about this liberation theme. And I do that because I think it ties in so nicely with some of the things going on in Holden. The Latin American writers are saying that you shouldn't talk about development, development of a country, because development does not get at the root problem. And it leads to frustration. The root problem, you see, is this dependency. They like to use the term liberation because it's better, it forces the discussion and the attention on this domination or dependency as they see it coming from the North. Liberation vocabulary lays bare the structures of dependence and denomination. And they add, and this is why I think this has a lot to say to us too,
It unmasked the high human cost of economic development if you go Western, the Western style, all the Western style. It's a language of hope. They're saying that they don't want to be mere consumers of a technological civilization. They want to transform their own country. And so the countries that have really gotten into liberation movements say, we want to have some control of what's going to happen in our own country. We want to dictate what will take place during that transformation. They say that development then, and they'll use liberation, must be debated morally. It's an ethical, value-laden, humanist approach, deeply rooted in history. It's not some abstract theory. Now, what they're doing is they're talking about more self-development, self-reliance. Remember, that means efficiency will be sacrificed somewhat if you try to do more by yourself. But they're seeing that as a better route to go. That's a fairly important movement in some of the countries today. Now, I'm going to tie Holden in just for just a few minutes. I think that I see some of the same things going on at Holden. Maybe it's, you know, some liberation thing. There's a different structure here. It doesn't appear that Holden is quite as hung up on the Western style of development and all the sophisticated technology and consuming and buying more and more goods. Holden appears to want to be there in some control of their own transformation, some of the things they're trying to do here in this community. Social justice is important. It's not just simply economics that is important here, but it's the development of the person and the social development also. That may be more highly valued than efficiency. If you came for a real first class vacation where you've got people specialized who can really provide the services and the tasks and everything is nice, I don't think you would have been coming here. But maybe Holden sees something, sees it a little different. You don't want to be dependent on what's going on out in where many of us are from. We get caught up in more and more growth, higher and higher technology. Maybe here they're willing to sacrifice a little on efficiency, the way they hire people. It's more of a giving community. And in that process, you find people with who are interested in personal development and relating on a social level. I guess I'm an economist who's supposed to talk about economic growth and about development and how we have unlimited material or unlimited wants. But I don't know. Just as this area here may be underdeveloped, I think part of the issue is this part may be coming overdeveloped to the point where our high level of consumption and economic growth may have some great costs, whether they're environmental or the loss of good, sound human relationships. And so what I started in economic development because I was so interested in what was going on down here. But in the last few years, I find myself saying that, gee, the same things I teach about down here, I don't know, I think maybe they're just as relevant for those of us who are up here. And I'm not for one second saying let's get rid of large corporations and make all these kinds of drastic changes. But I think there's some alternative ways of doing some things. And I think Holden may be in the midst of one of those experiments.